Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the latest in our series of Empire Podcast Spoiler Specials. This one is very exciting, very, very exciting indeed. So exciting, Nick Desimlian may just spill his tea all over his laptop. That's how exciting it is. It is dedicated to the 9th, or 10th, but who's counting, film in the oeuvre of Quentin Tarantino, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. How exciting. And joining me over the next 45 minutes to an hour or so to discuss the film in spoilerific detail are three of the gang. Shall we say? One's been cut from this. No Tim Roth here. Instead, we have Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm here to do the devil's business.
No, it was dumber than that. Joined by Ian Freer, who's very much like the sort of the Cliff Booth of
this
pod in many ways.
In many ways.
Thank you very much. Also, because I want to say by the way, it's 10 films. He's made 10 at the moment, so it'll be 11 films. And I know this for a fact because I paid £34 to see Kill Bill 1 and 2. It was £17 each. So it's, as far as I'm concerned, it's the 11th. This is the 10th film.
So you're
film
saying
of,
if the cinema charges you for both,
that's two films.
Isn't it? That's a fair assessment.
Oh my God, here we go. We're getting straight into it. Two films released months apart, both of which have their own credits and outros and intros. I'm saying they're two different films.
Yeah, but I'm saying £34.
That's £34. £34 in Freer.
So we should probably tell Tarantino, so he doesn't need to do another one.
He's probably really embarrassed.
Yeah.
Yeah, what a way to go out. A love letter to Hollywood is a way to go out.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
So Nick Desimlian has also joined us. Hello, Nick.
Hello, pumpkin puss.
Chris doesn't actually like that name.
I don't like that name.
I don't care.
Okay.
But you're upset, so we'll talk about it later.
Yeah.
So this is the 9th or 10th film, depending on your point of view, from the director Quentin Tarantino. It's very, very exciting. And as ever, this is a spoiler special. So if you have not seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood yet, then stop listening to this podcast right now. Hide to your nearest multiplex or independent cinema. Mm. See the film. All 2 hours, 45 minutes of it, and then come back and listen to this. And why should you listen to this? Well, because us four giggling idiots are going to be talking about it, but also because we're about to hear from the man who wrote and directed the film itself, and I'm very, very excited by this, Quentin Tarantino, talking pretty much for the first time, actually, about a lot of the spoilerific third act stuff, big revelations in the movie, and of course, why he did what he did with the end and with the course of history. Very exciting indeed. And he was in good form. Didn't get into everything with him. Only had about 34 minutes, something like that. So there are some big questions we didn't get into. Hopefully we'll talk about those after we're done. But this is Quentin Tarantino on the Empire Podcast for the first time. And probably last. Once he hears us talking about 10 films versus 9. Enjoy. We're delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast for the first time. I can't believe this is the first time you've been on the Empire Podcast, Quentin Tarantino.
Yes. I think I'm coming here before you guys had podcasts, all right? So that's...
I know. But you're here now. It's all
yes,
good.
I am. Yeah.
It's all good with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And you must be delighted with the reaction so far in the States, the opening weekend, your biggest yet.
Yeah.
And also, I guess, generally, do you keep your ear to the ground in terms of how people are reacting to the film as well?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean... we're here like the Tuesday after it opened in America, and so just before I got on the plane on Monday, it was Wednesday I think today. I don't even know what day it is, but I just spent the whole weekend going all over Los Angeles. Seeing it play at this theater. I saw it play at the Bruin, where she goes to, at the Cinerama Dome, at my theater, the New Beverly. And so, and one of the things about my movies is I have scenes where the audience is kind of supposed to react.
Yeah.
Either it be laughter or suspense or exclamation points or whatever the deal is. So it's pretty easy for me to walk into a theater and see whether or not the movie's working or not, because I have all these like signposts along the way.
Yeah. Do you go up to the counter and go, can I get into this movie for free?
Normally the idea is I'm trying to sneak in without like causing too much of a commotion.
I imagine at the New Beverly, you're pretty sorted anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay, that's the one place I can't sneak in.
I mean, there are a number of scenes I think that are designed to elicit that reaction.
reaction from audiences, mm-hmm. as you say. And I think it's hard to talk about this movie in a way without really kind of starting with the end, mm-hmm. In a strange way, because I imagine that's where you began when mm-hmm. you first began to conceive of this project. In terms of revising what happened to Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring mm-hmm. and everyone else in the house on that night, I get the feeling that you are gripped by a burning sense of injustice, obviously, that what mm-hmm. happened on that night is horrendous, yeah. and you're using the power of cinema to rewrite history. Is that where you began?
No, that really kind of is. I mean, I guess the real beginning was witnessing a dynamic between an actor had been at things for a while mm-hmm. and their stunt double that had been working for at least around a decade together. You know? So that's, I think, where I first came up with it. But then once I actually started coming about putting together a story, then yeah, I did come up with the end first and then had to work backwards to get there. But yeah, there is a, you can say, oh, I'm using the power of cinema to right wrongs or whatever yeah. that, I mean, I think the sentence I would use is metaphorically saving Sharon.
Yeah.
I think that's really what it comes about, you know. And I think there is, I think that last half hour can be excruciating mm. because you've gotten to really care for this woman.
Yeah.
And as you're hurtling towards her demise, it should be kind of horrendous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly my reaction the first time around, mm-hmm. especially the way you begin to go into forensic detail of the day. You're breaking it down. Mm-hmm. You have narration as well. Mm-hmm. And it's very mundane.
No, it almost seems like a little a true crime reenactment yeah. TV drama.
Yeah, precisely. And is that why you introduced it? Obviously, you have narration a little bit early on in the film as well. You have that one throwaway line. Yeah, that's a big fucking line.
Well, I had a couple little more moments. Spaced out through the movie. They kind of just ended up not making the cut. Like, for instance, like when Sharon is, when you see her folding clothes, mm-hmm. all right, that was, Roman was going to London that night.
Okay.
All right, so that was, one of the things she always did was pack a suitcase for him.
Yeah.
So I had a little narration saying that. When she bought the Tess of the D'Urbervilles book, I could have stopped and had a little narration that explained how he made the movie and it was because she bought him the book. Ultimately, I didn't think I needed any of that, but that was the idea.
Yes. There's a lot of stuff around the edges that you could fill in, but if you had Kurt Russell interrupt the film every 5 seconds.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
15 hours long. But also, that is Kurt Russell as well. Can you talk
talk
about that, him pulling double duty as Randy and the narrator?
Well, Paul Thomas Anderson used Ricky Jay as both his narrator and a character in, I believe it was Magnolia.
Yeah.
And I thought that worked out pretty good, so I didn't have any questions about that.
Yeah.
And then, but also I like the idea that, one, Kurt Russell actually has a very good voice for this kind of thing. I actually recorded about 4 different people doing it, with Kurt being one of them. And was sort of like, okay, well, whichever one, I don't know which one's going to win, so we'll see. All right. And, you know, Kurt kind of won in a hands down. And everyone else did a good job. But the thing is, what was great about Kurt, one, he's got a good voice for this. And he pulled it off really well. But also the fact that Kurt is almost like a narrator from the time period. He was there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Kurt actually, a lot of these shows that are mentioned and are brought up, Kurt did them. Shows.
Yeah.
You know, Kurt was on The Virginian. He was on High Chaparral. He was on these things. Now, you know, he was like 12 or 13 or 15 when he did them, but he still did them.
Yeah.
You know, he is of this era. He knows exactly what I'm talking about. So there is that aspect, you know, almost like the way the DJs are a period narrator.
Yeah.
Talking about the story. He's like a period narrator.
He would have been in Bound for
Glory. Yeah, he could have absolutely. Well, he's a little too young. He would be too young for Bound for Glory, but his dad, Bing Russell, would have absolutely been in Bound for Glory, and he would absolutely know who Rick Dalton is, and he probably would have worked with Rick Dalton somewhere along the line.
So as well as having this forensic true crime countdown towards the events in the Tate house, you also have, though, this wild card mm-hmm. of Rick and Cliff.
Mm-hmm.
And the audience, and I was wondering, well, what's going to happen? How are they going to affect the outcome of this, especially since you built Cliff up throughout the movie to be almost this indestructible fighting machine?
All right.
Then you do another interesting thing. Mm-hmm. You make one of them blind drunk mm-hmm. and oblivious in a swimming pool.
Yeah.
And the other one stoned out of his gourd.
Yeah, tripping balls. Can you say the F word on this?
Of course you can.
Okay, tripping fucking balls.
Tripping fucking ballsacks. Is that a technical term? I think it's a technical
term. Yes, I think that it is.
It's a technical term.
In Brooklyn, it is.
Yeah. Where did that idea come from in terms of ratcheting up the tension? Because I imagine most audiences will know what happened mm-hmm. to Sharon and Jay.
Yeah.
But some won't.
Well, having Rick be drunk during this going on, that's kind of easy because he just seems to be drunk
every night. Yeah.
But the Cliff smoking the acid cigarette actually is not in the script. I came up with that later. I came up with that. I came up with that way, way after the fact. I came up with it just before. And we didn't shoot the end till the end of the movie.
Okay.
I normally don't shoot my the end is usually the last thing I shoot in my movie because I wanted to kind of make the movie. Because mm-hmm. yeah, part of the thing is I write these scripts that are just like big novels.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then I'm basically adapting the novel every day into a movie. And then I adapt it even further in the editing room. But consequently, because of that, I try to make my movies in somewhat order. That's not always the case, but to some degree, at least as far as the end is concerned, I kind of save it for the end. For the simple fact that as I'm getting to it, it's like, okay, well, there's what I wrote, but now I know what I've made.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
Now I know what I think I have.
Yeah, yeah.
And so now I might have a better idea of what I need to bring my movie to climax.
Yeah.
All right. And I don't like that term. I mean, you know, it's not going to be that different from what I've done. I mean, from what I wrote. But if there is an aspect of, look, I do kind of know now more the movie I made.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I just came up with the idea of the acid-dip cigarette. I saw, I watched, you know, there was a lot of pseudo-documentaries done mm-hmm. in the late 60s about the hippie movement where mm-hmm. it's like some things are staged, but some things are real. Mm-hmm. And what was it? It was a movie called Revolution. And I've had the soundtrack album for it for a long time, and finally I got a chance to see the movie. And there was literally a scene of a flower girl selling acid-dip cigarettes. just literally, people stopped at a light. You know, just like, you know, you stopped at a light waiting for the light to change, and she'd come, hey, you want to buy an acid-dip cigarette? And actually, the dialogue was just like, what does that do? Smoke it to get you high. And so I wrote that down as just a possible thing.
Yeah.
To put in the movie at some point. And so I wrote it down as a possible thing to have somebody approach Cliff. And then I thought, well, hell, why don't we just have him smoke the cigarette that night? And it's one of the better ideas I've ever had, I gotta say. It's almost like the entire end almost turns on it, even in a way that I wasn't quite prepared for. And I kind of get the audience in the right frame of mind uh-huh. for what's going to happen because of the acid-dip cigarette. And it was funny because like Tom Rothman, he didn't know I did that. And so he's watching the movie for the very first time. He's like, where the fuck is all this coming from? Man, I must be losing it because I don't remember reading that in the script. I go, well, actually, we kind of edited it just like the last couple of weeks before we shot it.
It's great. It unbalances everything. It unbalances Cliff. It adds to this kind of, you know, the trippy ballsack nature of the scene. You know, the Manson family are high as well. So it all feeds in.
Yeah.
And it kind of maybe, as an audience, maybe you're thinking, well, maybe Cliff is going to be mm-hmm. not quite as indestructible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's for sure. And also there is this aspect about Cliff that, and I think, you know, this is one of those things I've learned from being a dramatist, is you can create anxiety in audience members because they've watched a lot of movies and even they mm-hmm. have more... They have more insight into how the drama is going to flow than they consciously think they do. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of subconscious working on it. And so the thing about it is it's one of those things where dramatically Cliff could die.
Yeah.
He's the one of the characters that dramatically could die and it would almost kind of make sense for the story.
Yeah.
Well, if you actually have a character that dramatically you can imagine killing and the audience actually cares for that character. Oh, well, you can go to town with the audience. Because they literally are scared for him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're worried for them, yeah. All right, in a way that they might not be worried for other characters in the movie. Yeah. And then, like, you can really go to town on an audience's nerves when you actually luck out with that kind of situation.
I get that. And that comes into play as well in the mm-hmm. the Spam Movie Ranch scene.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
Where the tone of the film just suddenly shifts.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's really unsettling. It's almost like a horror film, that entire sequence.
Yeah. Well, my editor, Fred Raskin, said to me, when he got the dailies, for it. And he started just like the first 3 days of dailies of Cliff kind of entering the place and, you know, seeing the girls, checking him out and whatever. And, you know, he was like, wow, Quentin, I didn't realize we were making a horror film. I go, oh, so you think the footage is good? He goes, yeah. I mean, it's like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I mean, but like, you know, with a budget and like an all-female cast almost. He goes, it's really creepy. And like, I agree. I mean, I think it's one of my best sequences I've ever done. And I think like everybody in that sequence is kind of perfect.
Yeah. And the whole movie is about putting back the confrontation, putting back the confrontation. You have that amazing shot of Tex riding on the horse, and getting in up to the ranch, and just as Cliff pulls away, and it's all about this delayed, almost gratification in a way of holding back what happens to the end, because the end is almost cathartic in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
Is that how you intended it?
There's
elements of comedy in there as well, obviously.
Yeah, there's definitely comedy in there. All right, as it goes on, and you know. Yeah, it's like it's meant to have a similar impact to what the final sequence of Straw Dogs has, except with some gallows humor thrown in there.
So some gallows.
And actually, I'm kind of. Rooting for the lead characters more than I'm rooting for Dustin Hoffman, and I kind of hate the other characters more than I hate those blokes that are messing around in Straw Dogs.
Yeah. That's fair. That is fair. Can we talk about the last shot? Can we talk about that?
Yeah, because
I'm fascinated by the last shot. The last shot of the movie is Rick, who is this guy who has been struggling to come to terms with this new Hollywood, and he has Polanski living right next door. And he suddenly he has inadvertently saved Sharon Tate's life.
Yeah, they don't know it either.
They don't know it either. And he gets this invite into this world that he has been struggling to understand. And it's this beautiful overhead shot. A lot of overheads in this movie as well.
We call him Sally's POV.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, didn't know that. And it's this beautiful overhead shot. Can you talk about ending the movie in that way?
Well, you know, it's funny because I came up with that image, that final image, 5 or 4 years ago.
Really?
And when I came up with it, I was like, wow, I think that could be one of the most powerful endings I've ever done. And I actually think the Hateful Eight ending is fantastic, too. But I came up with that, and it was wonderful. And then... but then I put it away, and one of the reasons I put it away is I'd done just a little bit of research on the Manson family, and I was just getting ready to do a deep dive and do more. And then this is like 4 years ago or something like that. And all of a sudden I was just like, wait a minute, let me stop before I get started on this. Do I really want to let the Manson family into my head?
Yeah.
Do I really want to let them into my psyche? And do I really want to think about where they were all coming from? Do I even want to find? I mean, because I wrote more scenes with Charlie than I ended up using in the movie. So it was like, do I want to know Charles Manson so much that I actually understand his vocal patterns, so I can write like realistic dialogue for him? Do I want to know him that much? Do I want to let these guys into my head that much? And the answer was no, I don't. And so I put it away.
Yeah.
But then the material that I wrote was good enough that I kept going back to it in between each thing. But the thing that really kind of led me along the way was that ending, was that ending shot. And so it's very gratifying that you like it. And then you say that it had effect, because it's been in my head for 5 years. So in fact, it was even weird because we did that earlier than I would imagine, because we had to shoot out those houses. So I think we shot that somewhere like only with like, we had a 100-day shoot, so like somewhere like around day 35 or something like that. And I was like, this is strange. I can't even imagine shooting more of the movie after we've shot that, because that was half the reason I wanted to do the movie.
Yeah.
So it was but it was very cathartic to have that in my head for so long and to work it out and do it and have it be exactly the way it was in my head and to capture it on celluloid. Yeah. That was one of the more cathartic moments.
Why did you want to end in particular with a Sally's POV?
Well, it was just, you know, I think it's like a Well, I don't want to put a button on it. I think it has its.
It feels like a fairy tale.
It has its own effect, and I want you to come up with it yourself. I don't want to tell you. I don't want to put it in a nutshell.
All right, fair enough.
But I'll tell you what. You know what gets me about it, though.
Yeah.
And this is different from my thought of it. The actual physicality is. It's very touching when you see Sharon show up there and you see her from above and you see her kind of hug Rick. And we're very happy for Rick that, like, you know, it's like the gates of the Emerald City have opened up and he's invited. And the fact that no one really quite understands the implications of what just happened, I like that. But what pushes me over the edge emotionally is when I see Abigail walk out there with that little robe of hers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In a strange way, she's become quite iconic in that little robe in a very short amount of time. Okay. And so there's something about seeing the four survivors all there with Rick, but there's something about Abby stepping out in the robe that pushes me over the edge every time I see it.
Oh, man. Mm-hmm. Also, Sharon's voice coming through on the intercom.
Oh, I know. No, that gets me too. Yeah,
And because the way, and I'm sure you've talked to people about this in the past already. The use of Sharon in this movie is very interesting. Yeah. The film is very much focused on Rick and on Cliff, and we get these glimpses of Sharon and going around almost a day in the life.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's exactly what it is.
Exploration of Sharon. Otherwise, she's not on the periphery of the film because she's very much a part of the film, but she's almost there as an ideal. In a way,
it's a double combination. On one hand, she's an ideal, all right. On one hand, she's an ideal. On one hand, she's a symbol. On one hand, she's this walking, talking sunbeam. That is kind of sounds like how she kind of was to some degree or another. And you know, but there is an aspect of she's representing something. Mm. You know, she's almost like a friendly ghost.
Yes.
Haunting the movie, but in a lovely way. So that's one hand.
Yeah.
To me, the other hand is she's less of a literary character that an actor is playing to get at an inner truth, which I guess is the difference between what most people think of when they think of characters, especially a literary character.
Yeah.
And she's more of an actress playing a real person, doing real person things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so she's not so much a character as it's like she's an ideal and a representation of the life that was actually lived.
Yeah.
But without trying to put her inside of melodrama.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or have her be a chess piece on a board that is ultimately playing to a plot.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is what the game of a chess would be.
Yeah, absolutely.
There is no plot to what she does.
Yeah.
You know, conceivably, the things that you see her doing, running errands, taking a walk, folding clothes, listening to records, talking to her friends, just kind of doing her day, driving around, listening to the radio, you know, doing her stuff. That's her living life, which is what the Manson family stole from her.
Yeah.
Which is what she was denied.
Yeah.
And even the idea that most people, when they think about Sharon, they think about the tragedy of her ending.
Yeah.
I mean, she's almost been defined. She has been defined.
She has been defined,
she has been defined by the tragedy of her ending. So I thought there was something special about just seeing her live life.
Yeah.
Because that is what was taken from her.
That's lovely. And also, as well, when she goes to see the wrecking crew,
that's one of my favorite sequences in the movie. And that was actually, it's also one of those weird sequences that's kind of hard for a studio to get behind. Well, why are we watching this? All right. And one of the best things about Khan is so many critics said that was one of their favorite things. And so all of a sudden, I wasn't bugged by that. People weren't bugging me anymore about that sequence.
But you also choose to use the real Sharon.
You
didn't recast that or reshoot that with Margot.
No. I thought it was, one of the things that I really, the Wrecking Crew is a beyond asinine movie. And I'm a big fan of Phil Carlson, the director. I'm not a fan of his Matt Helm movies particularly, all right? But I like Phil Carlson. He did Walking Tall. It's a great movie. But I saw that movie when it came out. I saw it in 1969. I saw it at the Garfield Theater in San Gabriel. Wow. And you know, when I was a kid, I thought it was very funny. I really, really liked it a lot. But one of the things about the movie that I love, I mean, there's that moment in the when you see her outside the theater and you see her looking at the poster and seeing her name and looking at the lobby cards and stuff. I'm just you know, I'm like 5 or 6 when I saw the movie. So naturally, a pretty girl like Sharon, who's a klutz and who's funny and is doing all this funny stuff, of course she's my favorite character in the movie. I had no idea who the hell she was. So I remember actually walking, and it was a very, in the Garfield Theater, it was actually not drastically different from the Bruin, yeah, at least as far as their patio on the outside was. So before we went to the car, I actually walked to the poster to see who played Mrs. Carlson. Miss Carlson, and I saw her thing, and her name is Sharon Tate, and I started because she was my favorite character. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie. The last gag is hysterical. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
The last gag is hysterical. Now you can now kind of see how they did it, but I mean, it brought the house down when I was a kid, and it's her just being a klutz at the very end, and it's just very, very funny. So the thing about it is, I'd seen a bunch of her movies, but I was really taken with her comic performance as Miss Carlson. And I thought she was a really lovely comedian. And so I thought there would be a really, it sounded like a bizarre thing. To me, I just always knew it would work. All right. And everyone else questioned it. And I just figured it would work. One, because I actually thought Margot looked enough like her that we could pull it off. But I also thought there could be an interesting, people use the word meta a little bit too much nowadays, but there could be a thing of her watching Sharon, watching her, that kind of stuff, back
absolutely.
And forth.
Because the whole movie blurs the lines between what's real, what's not. Bounty Law isn't, but Lancer is.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff.
Right on.
That's really interesting. And Cliff, in terms of the main character's interactions with the Manson family, it's interesting because Sharon gets that one brief interaction with Charlie Manson,
which is based on truth, actually.
He actually went to the house.
Went to the house to finally Terry Melcher wasn't calling him back, so he actually, I'm going to take matters in my own hands and visit the house.
And was there something else? A friend of mine, a colleague of mine at Empire, Nick, you showed him a little bit of the film in the build up to the movie's release, and apparently he saw a glance between Charlie and Cliff on the roof. Was that in there at one point?
No, that was in there, and I dropped it out and I kind of wonder to this day if I did the right thing, but Columbia really wanted me to keep it in. But it was one of those things where it was like part of the thing of guiding this movie was just knowing where the drama was.
Yeah.
And keeping the currentness of the drama in line with the audience's reaction. And it just seemed after that little brief moment, I should be going back to Rick for the scene with the little girl. When I stayed there just a little bit longer to have Cliff and Charlie share their moment, it just seemed like I was 5 minutes behind the drama or 3 minutes behind the drama from that point on. And we can get away with that, but it just felt wrong. Didn't feel right, because I'm not doing a thing where like one scene for Cliff, one scene for Rick, one scene for Sharon, one scene for Rick, one scene for Cliff, one scene for Sharon. No, we actually, when we're with Cliff, we'll follow him for 11 minutes, 12 minutes, 15 minutes. Yeah. All right, we'll be with Rick. We'll follow him for, 11, 12, 13 minutes. Same thing with Sharon. We're in there with like a nice little chunk of time.
Yeah, absolutely. And Cliff is interesting because Cliff is the person who has the most interaction with the Manson family. Obviously, he's by a movie ranch, but he's on the roof. He sees Charlie Manson pull up. Can you talk about that and the fact that Rick doesn't have any interaction until, obviously, the very end? He decided to keep him away from that and follow his own thread.
Did Leo give you this question to ask? I'm sure it chagrins him to no end.
He's listening in right now.
He's talking to you, right? Okay, ask him about why Rick doesn't have more to do with Charlie. it's just the way. It actually fits into kind of a lot of the themes of the movie. I mean, there was no without doing yoga like Limbo, all right, to get Rick involved with the Manson family. It didn't organically present itself that way. He gets dropped off on the set and that's that. And you're with him. But it actually fits into a lot of the things that we're doing because, two things that a dramatic thread that I think has fallen through a lot of my movies. And I can only say this now because I've never been purposely trying to put them in, but now that I've done enough of them, I can look and see, is one, taking acting or taking the life of an actor and applying it to other things that other human beings do in real life, starting with Detective Holdaway teaching Mr. Orange how to be an actor, you know, to be a successful undercover cop.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of performer in real life keeps playing. There's a, there's usually some point in one of my movies where a character pretends to be somebody they're not.
Yes.
And whether or not they can pull that off, usually life and death is usually involved in that situation. I mean, it just keeps happening again and again and again and
Most
again.
Most of the Hateful Eight, for example.
Yeah, exactly. but then also, there is duality. There is duality kind of going on in my movies where it's like two characters or two set of characters will kind of end up going through the same dramatic paces, except they'll have different outcomes.
Yeah.
And almost the duality of it is almost the point of it, whether it be the one group of girls in Death Proof versus the other group of girls.
Yeah.
In Death Proof. And in both of those cases, like literally almost the exact same things happen in different guises to all of them, except just the outcome is different.
Yeah.
And I've never had a better situation that is more dramatically set up than a heroic Western actor, TV actor, and his stunt double, where it is the idea that the actor is pretending to be a hero, his job as an actor, and he's a heroic actor. He's not playing weird little character roles or, you know, or weird idiosyncratic characterizations. No, he's a hero. He puts on a hat and he rides horses and he shoots guns.
He's a lantern-jawed leading man.
Yeah, that's exactly what he is. And unfortunately, right when that is seeming passé. But the thing is, though, is that's his job. He walks down Western sets and he confronts either, if he's the bad guy, he confronts the hero in this dramatic way, or he confronts the villain in this dramatic way, and he always comes out unscathed.
Yeah.
Where when things get really hairy, then you put Cliff in.
Yes.
And he takes the punishment. He takes the abuse. He's the one that takes the risks. He's the one who pays for Rick's heroics. Now, that was back in the salad days when everything was fine. But now it's playing out in a different way. I mean, if you think about it, during the course of that Sunday, both Rick and Cliff walk down Western towns.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
True. And face dangerous opponents.
Yes.
And don't miss a beat. Yeah. The difference is when Cliff is facing his opponent, Tex Watson, he's facing one of the most famous killers of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And one of the things that actually makes me very happy, like I said about that whole thing about the character that is dramatically perishable at that moment, is it seems like I've set Cliff up to be completely indestructible. So the fact that by the time we get to Spahn Ranch and it's just a bunch of girls hanging out there and you're still scared for Cliff, all right, just shows that, oh, wow, I think the mise-en-son of Spahn Ranch is correct.
You mentioned there the scene with Trudy Fraser, the little girl. I love that. Rick's breakdown, the easy breezy story.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Is really interesting.
It's pretty much all one take, too, from the moment, like, way before he even starts telling the easy breezy story. That's all one take.
Oh, wow.
And that wasn't because I shot at a bunch of different angles. It was just that take ended up just kept holding.
Yeah. That's really cool. Was that something that came to, was that just organic in terms of the parallels between Easy Breezy and Rick, then his discovery of that? And
Gosh, that was interesting. Yeah, I know. I'm sure when I started writing the Easy Breezy story, I knew where I was going to go with it. All right. But the organic part was just inventing Trudy at all. I think Trudy was actually the last character I came up with. I've been working on this story for a while. So like in between each movie, I would was this Sisyphus or Sisyphus?
The guy Sisyphus.
Who was pushing the rock up the hill. All right. So every time in between each movie, like starting from Death Proof on, all right, I would just work a little bit more on it and just move the rock up the hill and just figure I'd stop at a certain point and then pick up the next thing. And then after Hateful Eight, I started doing that again. And then all of a sudden I just went past where I normally went and I realized, oh shit, I'm going to finish this. This is the time. So I've been waiting for the chicken to come out of the, or the egg to come out of the incubator. Well, I guess this is the time. And so now writing the piece in earnest and trying to get to an ending, the last character I came up with was Trudy. And I think I came up with that scene. And I was like, wow, that's terrific. I really liked that. I was really, really into it. And then I was sort of like, then I had to kind of almost re-engineer the rest of the drama so that could fall in right in the middle and so she could have a right spot.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's also interesting because she has a positive impact on Rick.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's intriguing to me that you go out of your way to show in these long takes, mm-hmm. and especially that bit at the end with Evil Hamlet,
yeah, yeah.
that he is a good actor.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
That he's not just a joke.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of the actors that I based Rick on, at the end of the day, I really like them. And I think, you know, part of the poignancy of some of them is if things had been different, if they had caught a lucky break, or, you know, they could be sitting in a different situation, whether it be Tab Hunter or George Maharis or Ed yeah. Cookie Burns or, you know, a lot of guys,
yeah.
you know, Ty Harden, and they didn't get the flashy role in the John Sturges epic, The Great Escape, to set them up.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I wish we had time to talk about that.
However, I think there is this aspect, though. One of the things about putting Rick in The Great Escape is McQueen's ultimately better for the role. Yeah, Rick does a good job, but I would cast McQueen.
That's true. Although, you know, Leo on a motorbike, that'd have been pretty cool.
That would have been pretty cool.
We're
not talking about Leo. We're talking about Rick. I might cast Leo in Rick. The Great Escape.
Yes, of course. So many layers, Quentin. Yeah, many layers to get through. But I imagine Rick Dalton is a character that, you know, is an actor that you might have cast in Reservoir Dogs.
Oh, absolutely. No, I could. No, I could actually see. Well, let me think about that for a second. Actually, so okay. So Rick is in his 40s, mm-hmm. In 69. So, I mean, the part he would be right for would be Joe.
Actually, no, I think Lawrence Taney was pretty, yeah. might have been a better choice. And then real quick, because someone's going to kill me if I don't ask this, Tim Roth, brackets cut. Yeah. What's the story there?
Oh, he played, just didn't make the cut, all right. But he's part of the gang, and I appreciated him showing up and being giving his due diligence service, all right? He was Jay Sebring's British butler.
Okay.
His British gentleman's gentleman.
Just a walk-on, walk-off situation.
It's pretty funny. No, it was a funny little sequence, but it got dropped.
Man. Oh, man. Okay. Well, fantastic. Quentin, I could talk to you all day about this movie, and indeed your other movies, but I'll let you go.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And thanks for seeing the movie twice in 24 hours. That's beyond the call of the duty.
It's all I can think of at the moment. It's in my head, and there it shall stay.
I've had those feelings with the movies before, and it's always a good feeling to have.
Fantastic. Cheers, cool. Man. Thank you.
All right. So that was Quentin Tarantino. And there's still a lot to get into in terms of this movie. But first of all, let's go around the table. I've got some listener questions as well. We may get into those in due course. But let's go around the table and kind of establish where we are. Are we all Tarantino fans? Where do we stand on this movie in terms of his oeuvre, his 9 or 10 film oeuvre? Ian,
I reviewed it for the Mag and I gave it 4 stars.
So you hated it then?
Yeah, I kind of think it's... On the first viewing, I kind of think it's middle order Tarantino. I just felt that, you know, it's a film about a man who's kind of at the end of his career, or he sees like the edge of his talent, and he's worrying about he's a man out of time, and he can see a new generation sort of coming up behind him. And that was a hard relate for me. I kind of got that.
I think. Did you not make the point that it's a bit less quotable than your average Tarantino?
I thought so. Yeah.
Because that might be true, although I have started calling cars mechanical assholes,
right.
Which is a nice line, yeah. But generally there isn't...
I just thought there's loads of brilliant things in it, loads of great performances, loads of great scenes, lots of funny moments, lots of motifs. But for me, when I think of Reservoir Dogs isn't a difficult film to follow, but you have to follow it. This one, I thought you could wander around for 10 minutes, come back, and you'd still catch up with it, you'd still get it. So it's a kind of a hangout movie, and it has the pleasures of that, but it doesn't feel as essential as some of these other things to me.
You could argue that you could cut the first day and you could still have the same movie.
Okay.
I think. I don't think you need the Pacino stuff necessarily. I really enjoy it, but you could cut all of that first day and just have it the 2 days, I think.
Just the Sunday.
And it would still function. Yeah.
I was wondering why they were shooting on Sunday. Was that normal back in the day? Was it normal to shoot your guest stars on a Sunday?
Maybe, yes.
It was weird. Yeah, and they kind of suggested that Cliff works on Sundays as well. So, seven-day-a-week gig.
Well, you know, I can believe, actually, because it's kind of half hanging, half working. Nope. I'm not as much of a Tarantino Nutter?
Stan.
I'm not. That's the word. That is the word, actually. I'm not as much of a Tarantino stan as many in this magazine, I think it's fair to say. I admire him enormously. I admire his films. They do not live in my heart. I do not know if any of them would be in my top 100 of all time, actually. I admire them. I just, they're not mine. So please bear that in mind when I say that this is probably my favorite of all of his films.
Holy shit. Yeah. This is your 101st greatest film of all time.
Why did you say that, Hal?
Because I really enjoyed the atmosphere. And I know I 100% agree with you. It is a hangout movie. It lacks any real sense of urgency apart from about a 5-minute period towards the end. And maybe the bit on the ranch. There's a tension. There's real tension.
That's
there.
Terrific. Yeah.
Yeah. But generally speaking, I really enjoyed the hangout. I really enjoyed the feeling of a bygone era brought to life. I really liked the sense I got from this film, as with Hail Caesar, of simultaneously thinking that movies are the most important thing in the world and thinking they're faintly ridiculous. And do you know what I mean? I feel like both of those films, which are otherwise completely unalike, I think both films do that really, really well. And that I really, really dug.
One thing I loved about it is that it's a film about the Dream Factory, yet it feels like they're his most real people.
Yeah.
You know, all the films, all the other 9-8 films, whatever you want to call it.
I'd say Jackie Brown maybe comes the closest to having.
Yeah, but a lot of the times they don't feel like real people.
It's like Jackie Brown in the sense that it's about losers. It's about, you know, the people who haven't made it necessarily. Mm. You know, whereas maybe in Pulp Fiction you've got these very, very cool characters who have swagger, and these guys don't necessarily have. Cliff does.
Cliff
but he's still a bit of a loser. Like, he goes
his caravan
macaroni cheese.
Yeah, that caravan is horrific. Yeah. And I mean, if he wasn't Brad Pitt, wearing a all-white denim suit for a night out would be unforgivable. He's Brad Pitt, so he can do that. But, like, that's not a thing that a human being should attempt. I think it's after Labor Day as well. I mean, you don't wear white after Labor Day.
And that's a Saturday night as well.
I mean,
that's a Saturday night.
That is a high level of difficulty. That's what that is.
I mean, it's quite similar to my Saturday nights. But I think it's his most fun film for a while. I think it's just him having fun. You know, it ends with Adam West and the Batman song. Just like, and it's skits as well. It goes off on little segues, some of which I didn't love as much as others. But overall, I really liked it. It's a mood piece. I really loved all the driving stuff. Like, I wanted more driving, just listening to the radio with, it's just
great
so
music.
Cool.
Yeah.
It's weird how watchable those driving scenes are.
And it is also very... I think it's more compassionate than most of his films. That's not a word I would particularly associate with Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah.
And this felt very, very compassionate, especially at the end, giving us a sense of hope for Rick in a weird way. You know, he's kind of, he's in with the in crowd. He's getting to go and hang with them for a little bit.
Yeah.
If they are the in crowd, I'm not sure. The film is kind of on the fence about that.
They're fairly in crowdy, I would say.
They're inner than Rick at that point.
Anyone is inner than Rick, even after his four film stint.
It posits that, maybe Rick could have starred in Chinatown in this version of history.
Whoa.
I was thinking about, how could this have impacted Hollywood history? I don't know. But it's fun to kind of think about.
Wow.
But I think that's true. I think this is the most optimistic, maybe even romantic Quentin Tarantino film. I don't think he's got a rom-com in him somehow.
No.
I don't know, but I'd love to see it if he did. I think this is a romantic rewriting of history, even more so than killing Hitler at the end of Inglourious Basterds, because Hitler died anyway. It was heading in that direction anyhow. But here, as he said in the interview, that this was about saving Sharon Tate for him. That was the idea. He had this kind of idea, this hangout, this buddy dynamic between Rick and Cliff already. But then the idea of actually being audacious enough to save Sharon Tate and the other four people who died that night. There were five people who died in total at the Polanski-Tate household. It reminded me an awful lot of the plot development in Yesterday, where Danny Boyle and Richard Curtis contrived to keep John Lennon alive as well, where you're so appalled by the turn that history has taken and killing these innocent people. This is a spoiler special
spoiler
for Yesterday
special
as well.
For Yesterday,
I'm sure we'll spoiler special Avengers Endgame at some point. That's what we do. It's all we do. So yes, spoiler special for Yesterday, by the way, if you haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it.
But I'm sure you've read it in Empire magazine,
that's
right?
True, I had.
Yeah, okay, there you go. And it felt to me this was a similar, almost kind of altruistic gesture from him, giving Sharon Tate in particular back to the world. I think this is Tarantino, the movie fan, and Tarantino, for maybe for the first time, the kind of the generosity of spirit in him, giving something back to the world and giving this wonderful potential alternate future.
And it's not just the movies as well. It's the whole knock-on effect of the way that those murders changed the sort of the psyche in Hollywood. I mean, if you read biographies, like, everybody talks about that night as a night that changed them. Loads of people talk about they drove past my house. Loads of people talk about they were going to come for me next. You know, you come across all of these stories. Everybody felt touched by it personally because it's such a small town. And again, that's just almost that sort of psychological shift and what might have happened if that hadn't also occurred.
I don't necessarily think this, but do you understand why people would think this is just bad taste?
Yeah, but when it was
announced, I was really uncomfortable with it.
I thought this is what he was going to do when this was announced. I thought that there, in some way, Rick and Cliff were going to save Sharon Tate. I thought that's what he was going to do. I didn't know how he was going to do it. And as the film unfolded, I have to say, it was a really, really uncomfortable first watch for me because I didn't know where he was going with it. And as he begins to sort of break the movie down, the third act, into an almost forensic, and again, I'll repeat myself in the Tarantino interview, but that almost forensic true crime approach.
Yeah, where
Kurt Russell's narrating it almost minute by minute. And while Rick and Cliff were over here being idiots, Sharon Tate was doing this with her pals and she was going for dinner and then she came home and you're thinking, oh God, what's he doing? Is he building up to this thing where they're murdered horribly while Rick and Cliff are just oblivious because they're stoned and drunk and they don't see it, they don't hear it. Is it going to be that? And then he goes the way he went, which meant second time around I was able to fall into the film's fold a little more and I was able to soak up his vibes a little more and enjoy it a little more because the end is cathartic. It's meant to be cathartic. It's meant to be these utter shits. And if you read about what they did, my God. You came out, I remember you coming out the cinema the first time we saw it, Helen, you were like, if you read what they did, it's horrific.
Yeah.
And so they get what's theirs. And in a really weird sense, it is comedic and it's meant to be cathartic and it's awful and maybe even gratuitous, but you're meant to cheer it.
I felt uncomfortable watching it. I just thought watching that girl repeatedly get her face smashed in.
Yeah.
It was horrible. Mm.
I actually didn't, weirdly, just because of the violence of the crimes and the violence of what the real life woman did. I don't, you know, it didn't feel like, you know, a big strong man picking on an innocent or someone who wasn't able to defend themselves. It felt like somebody stopping a complete nut job.
I don't know. It is kind of played for laughs. And I saw it yesterday for the second time with an audience and people are laughing. And then there comes a point where everyone stops laughing because the violence, Brad Pitt, when he just starts smashing the head, like he does it three times.
Yeah.
And then he could have stopped there. Any other filmmaker would, I think, have stopped there. And he carries on. And there is a tonal shift. And I wonder if that's deliberate. It felt deliberate to me.
Of course, yeah. It's absolutely.
He doesn't want, he wants you to laugh. And then you start laughing again because the flamethrower comes out.
I think Cliff is like that all the way through. Mm. By the way, before we get onto that, I should go back to the early point when I started talking about that, because I don't think there's been a backlash about keeping Sharon Tate alive, or if there has, I haven't seen it.
No, and her sister was very supportive of the script and the film and her portrayal.
Exactly the same thing happened, because I remember, again, we're spoiling yesterday here, but I remember when I first spoke to Danny Boyle a couple months ago before the film came out, he said there's something that happens I think will piss off a lot of Beatles fans, and as far as I can tell, that hasn't pissed off any Beatles fans, because they're like, oh, it's beautiful. It's great. John Lennon's alive and, you know, screw Mark Chapman and all that stuff. And let's move on. And I feel the same thing here. But I also think that Cliff, who is mainly the sort of angel of death for the Manson family members in this movie, is a really, what Tarantino's doing with him is really, really interesting. In that he's clearly the coolest character in the movie. He's laconic. He's laid back. He's Brad Pitt. Looks great with the shirt off. Looks great with the shirt on. Looks great in white denim.
Didn't notice.
Did you notice?
No, didn't.
My wife noticed. I know that much. And why don't you look like Brad Pitt? It's beyond me. It is beyond. There's never been a point in my life where I could have looked like that. Anyway.
You look like Brad Pitt's stuntman.
I'm not even sure I do. I think I look like Paul Giamatti's stuntman. Anyway. But he's this really cool character that you're meant to root for. But he does a thing where I didn't get a chance to talk to Tarantino about this. He does a thing where he heavily implies that he did kill his wife.
Oh, yeah.
And so you're asking yourself, am I meant to be rooting for this guy? How complicit am I in what's going on here?
Yeah, I think, first of all, in terms of the death of his wife, so what we're showing is clearly meant to lead up to, at the very least, manslaughter. And he has that line to Bruce Lee about well, that's manslaughter. You go to jail for that anyway. So, you know, at the very least, it's an accidental death that is due to his accidental action. But it clearly seems a little bit less than 100% accidental. I think that's what we're meant to take from it. And I think we are maybe meant to draw some conclusions from that.
But I think that's the point of a lot of Tarantino's characters, you know, and a lot of Tarantino's films over the years, and that he has that relationship with the audience where he just pushes you in the just as far as you can go, and maybe even then a little bit further. And he's been doing that since Reservoir Dogs.
But I think,
is Cliff atoning for them? Is his savior a Sharon? And
no, well,
then,
I don't think he is, because he's not.
No, he doesn't
know that he's saving Sharon Tate. He doesn't even know who these people are or what they want. He just knows that people have come into his house.
He is literally tripping balls at the time.
Yeah. So
that also may affect things. But I think he is a really interesting character in that respect. And I think this question is a really interesting part of what makes him a really interesting character, because there's that throwaway reference to him being a war hero. There's Rick talking about, you can do anything you want to him, throw him off a building, you know.
Hit him with a Lincoln.
Hit him with a Lincoln.
He'll thank you for that.
Yeah. So all of that kind of implies a guy who is like extraordinarily physical, like extraordinarily maybe adrenaline junkie. The way he drives when he's in the car alone compared to when anyone else is with him, that is an adrenaline junkie. That is a dangerous person. That is a person without some normal.
Great shout.
Yeah.
Screw.
Yeah.
Tied on. But he's also this kind of really laid back, really charming, really outwardly happy character the whole time. And it feels like one of these people who is sublimating every single negative emotion that he has into these occasional acts of violence. And otherwise is just like totally calm.
Yeah. He's like a solar panel, isn't he? He's just storing it up constantly.
Yeah. There's some interesting contradictions with the character, because at one point he says, I've never been to prison. They've been trying to get me into prison all my life. And then about 20 minutes later, when he gets to the ranch, he mentions being on a chain gang for breaking a cop's jaw. So he contradicts himself there. And then this is either a mistake or a deliberate thing, but his flashback with the Bruce Lee thing, there's a big billboard for the film Tora Tora Tora. And if you look at when Green Hornet was shooting, that was like a few years, like 5 years before that film came out. Mm. So that doesn't jibe with that scene.
There was a suggestion that that was a that whole scene with Bruce Lee was a fantasy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It feels that way, because it's a flashback. He's on the roof.
Yeah.
He has the...
his shirt off.
Yeah. Does he?
I don't know. I didn't
you
notice.
Hadn't noticed. Yeah. Then he has a sort of flashback to being fired off the set of the Green Hornet with the fight with Bruce Lee. And that might suggest why that fight is a draw. Because it's his recollection or it's his fantasy. But within that, we have the flashback to the potential thing with the
double flashback. Yeah. Yeah. But I was watching the Bruce Lee scene yesterday with the mind of, is this a fantasy? And it didn't feel like it. Like, it goes back to him and he goes, fair enough.
Yes, that's the thing that killed the fantasy.
That doesn't feel like a daydream.
Well.
That feels like he's remembering something.
But do we think it's offensive? I read a lot of stuff that it's problematic.
Yeah, I think this is another interesting discussion. I've heard it from both sides, from Asian Americans. So I think the concern is that not so much that the portrayal of the character was wildly inaccurate. I've seen some people say that's totally who he was, that he was understandably
cocksure
to the point of arrogance. Yeah. And that he could be kind of, you know, aggressive and kind of start things. I don't know enough about Bruce Lee, I'll be honest, to know how true that is.
It's kind of deflating his legend, which I think people Bruce Lee fans have got upset about.
They were upset the fact that he got served by Brad Pitt.
Yeah, and just the way he's portrayed as you know, he's peacocking around, and then by the end of it, he looks quite small. You know, when Zoe Bell turns up, he kind of looks like a little boy almost. And I think because his image is so, he's the coolest man on earth.
I think the moment when she turns up, what he seems to be outraged about is the idea that she's telling Brad Pitt off for hitting him, rather than the opposite. And he's very anxious to get out the fact that he was not losing the fight.
It's like two kids at school when the teacher comes in, which is really funny. But Tarantino does the same thing with Steve McQueen. And the Steve McQueen, you know, you've got the coolest movie star hero, but then he's a bit of a sad sack, and he's, you know, he wants the girl and he can't get her.
Yeah.
So he's kind of deflating these legends.
Yeah, I think there was a bit of that. But I think what was interesting about this, Bruce Lee in particular, is that a lot of people picked up on the fact that it's the audience reaction when he starts speaking that's most disturbing. So it's not so much Tarantino's racism in...
Yeah, I read that.
I saw it on my own, no. Pretty much. So
the first time I saw it with an audience, there were right. titters when he starts speaking.
Really?
Yeah.
Brad Pitt did say in an interview that originally Bruce Lee lost the fight. Obviously, it's a draw, as is, but apparently Brad Pitt had a word with Tarantino and they rewrote it slightly. But Mike Mo, by the way, is amazing as Bruce Lee. Yeah. And the whole scene is done as one shot, which is amazing if you actually watch the camera work. It's really, really impressive. Yeah. Until he gets hit into the car.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's like 5 minutes of pretty amazing filmmaking.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of pretty amazing
filmmaking. Yeah, I mean, it's about 2 hours, 40.
Yes, it is.
But that's the most impressive bit of the film.
And Robert Richardson is the man, the cinematographer, he's the man of the match, isn't he?
He is, right.
It's beautiful. Yeah. Beautiful. It was
lovely
everything.
Assist from Richardson.
Yeah, exactly.
And whoever had to clear all the music and jingles.
Yeah, that's it. Oh, yeah, hats off to that. That's amazing. Absolutely. Yeah. I didn't feel there was I've seen it once, so maybe you guys have seen it more and you'll know more, but I didn't think there was a killer tune that you come out thinking...
Oh, like I've had that. I've had Neil Diamond's, Brother Love's Travelling Salvation Church. I'm getting the name wrong, but I've had that tune stuck in my head for 2 months now or something. It was in one of the trailers. And there's a perfume jingle I've had stuck in my head.
Oh, yeah, is it Heavenly?
Heavenly or Heaven Sent or
Heaven
something.
Sent,
so catchy. Yeah. I can't get that out of my head. It's brilliant.
Okay.
It's more of a jukebox approach to the soundtrack than he's perhaps done before.
Rather than those big kind of moments of, you know, stuck in the middle with you.
It's in the background, isn't it? A lot of songs are in the background stuff.
What was the one over the actual death scene? Because that was when the man's family would break in. Because that I remember loving, and I have a terrible memory for music, so it's already gone out of my head.
I'm terrible.
I quite enjoyed the fact that Aretha Franklin's The House That Jack Built plays as he pulls up to his trailer.
Yeah.
Because it's just the contrast of... You know, it's not even a built house.
What I will say is if you want to listen, if you want to hear more about the music of this movie and you want to hear more Tarantino, then Edith Bowman recorded an episode of her soundtracking podcast where Tarantino talks about his song choices and goes through it. I haven't heard it yet, but I imagine it's a fantastic episode of a very good podcast. So do check that one out.
I was exciting that Leonardo DiCaprio was singing Green Door, which if you're British is essentially Shaking Stevens, isn't it?
Yes.
The song over the end of the movie is the Manson attack is Vanilla Fudge's You Keep Me Hanging On, which Tarantino did his own edit of.
Going to the Playboy Mansion, they played that song Hush. So they covered it in the early
Cooler Shaker covered it.
Cooler Shaker.
Yeah.
It's Deep Purple, I believe.
Yes. So I've always been quite fond of the original of that.
Yeah.
That was good.
And it was Out of Time as well, which felt more on the nose than you might imagine.
Some of the tunes were quite on the nose, I have to say.
Yeah. We Are Family.
Yeah, I should have got that. Yeah. I haven't got the soundtrack yet. I should. Is it out? I mean, is it a...
It's on Spotify.
Triple LP?
Yeah, and it's got all the radio jingles and ends with Batman. God. It's amazing. Right. I've had it on quite a bit.
Because Tarantino is a big thing for me. He was a big thing for me at a formative point of my youth. And the Reservoir Dogs soundtrack was huge for me, just huge.
Yeah. Can we talk about Sharon Tate?
Of course we can.
Yeah.
I see a lot of things about that she hasn't got many lines.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily feel that's a problem.
No.
I just feel that acting's more about talking dialogue, isn't it?
It is. And I honestly don't think that question was meant to imply otherwise.
Yeah.
But if you are... Like, it was heavily talked about that Sharon Tate was a big part of the film. Margot Robbie was very much sold as the female lead. She is right there with them on the poster, most of the posters anyway, as a sort of co-equal lead. That is the sort of disconnect that I think people are talking about.
Yeah.
For the role that she plays in the film, she was oversold. The role she plays in the film, I think, is fine. It doesn't need more lines, but that is not a leading lady role. It is, at best, a supporting part.
Yeah, Margaret Qualley has more lines and more presence. She's the girl who Brad Pitt picks up.
Pussy, yes.
Yeah.
It's one of these things, it's always this stuff which we talk about a lot, but like we talked about it with Black Widow, it's not a problem that they killed... It's not a problem that they killed Black Widow. It's a problem that it's always the girl who has to die. So, you know, or it seems unjustly so sometimes. It's not a problem that Sharon Tate doesn't have many lines. It is a problem that so many female characters don't have many lines. So it's not in isolation anything wrong with this, but it is okay. But sometimes we have to raise eyebrows at high profile cases to get other people to think about
it. But do you see why he's done that? What is your feeling on why he did that?
I think
why
she doesn't need anything more to play the role that she has in the film, which is essentially an avatar of goodness and innocence.
Yeah.
But I like
one that
for
puts
example,
her feet up on the
oh my god,
dirty
feet
up on the chair.
Feet could lost, fuck yeah. off, honestly.
is this because I've got my feet up on the table right now?
If you could just put your shoes on, I would really appreciate it. But the problem I have is like somebody was, I was having a conversation with two journalists who I very much respect on Twitter.
Name them.
No, and one of them was saying, if she had more lines, she wouldn't work in that role. And that is where I draw the line, because that is not the case. She can still be...
She could have more scenes and still work.
She can still have more scenes and still work. And we
not
would
another
just
Sharon
be,
Tate scene. Oh, no.
Yeah. But the thing is, all anybody wants to say about her, all that he needs to say about her is that she was a good and a decent person and she loved life. And
how much drama is there in that?
And how much drama is there in
you know,
that?
Drama
yeah,
and is conflict and there's...
Yeah. Exactly.
There's and usually conflict in the Rick and Cliff scenes, whether they're together or whether Rick is on his own slowly disintegrating or whether Cliff is heading off to the Manson family ranch and, you know, giving the impression that either he's going to die or that he'll just punch all 15 of them straight out. So maybe the Sharon scenes don't really have that. Having said that, the trailers and the TV spots do hint at things that were cut from the film. And again, this is... I wish I had 2 hours of Tarantino, guys. You know, there's a scene, clearly that scene where she picks up the hitchhiker. There's a couple of shots from her inside her car where she's talking to someone in the TV
there's images of her in a swimming pool as well.
Images at the Playboy Mansion, I think that's where, you know, the
everybody's in a swimsuit at the Playboy Mansion.
Never been.
I know I was. Yeah. did you guys see the fake Wikipedia plot summary that went up after Cannes? And it was up for a while, but it was totally not true, the synopsis. And it was basically the Manson family do go to Sharon's house, but Bruce Lee and Steve McQueen turn up.
Oh, come on.
And help fight them off. Actually, sounds awesome.
I mean,
I was expecting Steve McQueen to turn up. Well, the first time I saw it, I was expecting Steve McQueen to turn up in some way at the end. I don't know why, just because it was such a short scene. I was like, there's got to be more.
It is interesting.
He's really good, by the way, Damian Lewis.
So yeah. Yeah, I didn't put that connection together when he was cast. I was like, Damian Lewis? No. Steve McQueen? Yeah. Really?
And then you kind of watch him and you're like, oh, I see.
Oh, yeah, Damian Lewis is Steve McQueen. I would have liked to see Damian Lewis play
that
Steve McQueen.
That's a smart thought, yeah.
Yeah.
That's brilliant, that scene. That is so charming, that scene. Yeah. That's so great.
The studio must have tried to get him to chop that. Because he's talked a bit about they tried to get him to lose the scene where Sharon goes to the cinema to watch herself. And you can kind of, you know, it doesn't push the plot forward at all. But there must have been tussles. Because it was originally 4.5 hours long.
Wow.
But it's interesting how he didn't shoot that with Margot
her.
Robbie.
Yeah.
He puts the actual Sharon Tate. Yeah. It's Sharon. It's Margot Robbie watching Sharon Tate, isn't it?
Yeah. It would have been funny if the lady behind the box office was like, no, that's not you. That's completely different.
But I think that was meant as a deliberate tribute. And I think that's going back to this idea of trying to do right by the real Sharon Tate, very much.
Well, one thing I wanted to say about Tarantino's female characters, which I thought the best character in the movie was Julia Butters playing this precocious young Meryl Streep-esque actor. I thought she was terrific. So great for her two scenes.
Yeah.
Just absolutely rips it apart. Well, that's the most Tarantino thing in the film to me. It's original writing that you wouldn't get anywhere else.
I thought Margaret Qualley was astonishing as well.
Yeah.
As Pussycat, who Cliff picks up. That's an amazing performance. She's great in that.
Well, many people know that she's Andy McDowell's daughter.
Yeah,
this is a genuine question. Like,
it's another thing I didn't ask Tarantino.
Sorry.
Fuck did I ask him?
Was it a deliberate choice to have so many Hollywood sons and daughters in this film?
Yeah, I think it's about passing the torch, isn't it? It's about generations superseding people, which is kind of the theme of the film, isn't it, a little bit?
Yeah, I think that's a big thing with Rick. And that's why I think it's a lovely grace note at the end that he does allow Rick to temporarily, at least. Here's the thing about Rick Dalton. You get a sense he's going to fuck it up somehow. But, but he gives him, what do they call it? An olive branch, in a way, to the younger generation. That's really, really nice. Because Rick is a man who is tortured by his own past. And I think in a weird way, that's almost what he's getting at with the casting of. So Ethan Hawke, Maya Hawke, Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman's daughter is in this as well. Who else do you have?
Rumor Willis.
Harley Quinn Smith is in it also.
Tarantino's talked about how these kind of these very manly actors in the 60s were supplanted by Michael Douglas and lots of other kind of people who were the children of movie stars. And they were
Kurt Russell's a son himself of, you know, Bing Russell. So there's people in, but I think Rick is someone who's tortured by his own past, and he almost invites it as well. What's fascinating is you look at Cliff's horrible caravan. I did wonder, I really did wonder about the dog. I like, do you really, because he's been out all day and that poor old dog's been in the trailer, and I hope it's getting the love and the affection that it needs.
I hope he has a dog walker there in his oil field in Van Nuys.
I hope that I hope there's an early version, an early 1969 version of BorrowMyDoggy.com, mm-hmm. and that someone's walking dear old Brandy every day. Otherwise, that dog isn't getting the lifestyle.
Brandy's okay. But, she's biting nuts. She's having the time of her life.
She really is. But you look at Cliff's caravan, you compare it to Rick's house, and Rick isn't finding all these posters of himself from his heyday, and he's almost torturing himself, and you wonder why he's an alcoholic and why he screams at himself. And it's interesting that in his driveway is a picture from from a poster of one of his movies, and it's, if you look at it, it's one of his,
it's
a Comanche movie, and it's someone with their boot literally on Rick Dalton's face, and that's, I think, sums up what he thinks of himself, and that's maybe why he keeps it around.
Yeah, I think it just made them laugh originally. I can see it making Cliff laugh anyway, and Rick sort of going along with that in a weird way.
Yes.
But I have to say, I'm not DiCaprio's biggest fan, generally speaking. I appreciate that he's great.
See the technique.
I don't love him.
He tries, doesn't he?
I think he's phenomenal in this film. Yeah. I think he's so freaking good. The way he introduces that little stutter in bits where Rick is uncomfortable.
Yes.
Just isn't sure what he's doing. His, virtually breaking down at the praise, not of the director, but of an 8-year-old, just speaks volumes as to how kind of confident he isn't. Almost breaking down at the beginning when Pacino basically explains why his career is on the skids. I just think there's so much there. And I do like that. Again, the film has the grace and the generosity to give him some wins. So it's not just the four films in Italy. He does genuinely appear to knock it out of the park.
Yeah, he's a good actor.
When called upon to do so.
But I thought that was absolutely strange, that all that Lancer stuff. I wrote question mark. A, what are we seeing? What the TV camera is seeing?
Yeah.
But TV cameras don't shoot like that.
Yeah.
But that was the weird thing, wasn't it? Because
sixties TV cameras don't frame and shoot like that.
It doesn't feel at all, because Lancer's obviously real. You can go on YouTube and you can watch the Sam Wanamaker episode. Yeah. It's nothing like it, because I had a look and it's weird. Yeah, he's doing his own thing. He's doing a Tarantino version of Lancer, but. Yeah, I didn't love it. And originally there was twice as much. There was twice as much Lancer.
That would have been too much.
There were four Lancer segments originally, and the editor said that they cut the first and the fourth one.
Right.
So you're getting the two. So actually, if they'd left the other two in, which they'll turn up on Netflix at some point, I think, but you would have been able to follow the whole episode. But I'm guessing there's lots of Scoot McNairy and Timothy Oliphant missing.
Were you a fan of Lancer then? Did you like those segments?
I find it slightly more trying the first time, actually, than the second time. The second time, again, I sort of relaxed and enjoyed it a bit more.
Yeah.
I was a little bit unclear as to if it's Johnny Madrid's show, why it's called Lancer, and who was playing Lancer or would have played Lancer. And
who's Johnny Madrid?
The Lancers are half-brothers. And in the show, the sister is not an 8-year-old.
Right.
She's 22. So he's made some quite dramatic differences. But I couldn't follow the Johnny Madrid stuff, to be honest.
Yeah. I thought Johnny Madrid was a Lancer.
I think he's the half-brother of...
Luke Perry.
Yeah.
It's interesting why he just didn't make up Bounty Law 2 or something. Yeah. Why he didn't come up with his own thing.
Yeah. He is blurring the lines. I mean, I'd love to take a third look at this movie and note down all the movies at the marquees, the night they raided Minsky's and
loads
of cinema stuff all over
based
the place.
On the marquee.
It's great.
Yeah. That episode of the FBI is a real episode with that character name.
That
character is played by Burt Reynolds. In the actual
really?
Episode.
Okay. Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Burt Reynolds was in the
Burt Reynolds
of the FBI.
Was guest starred in it. Yeah, played that character that DiCaprio plays.
Wow, that's an even bigger fall than Rick Dalton would have experienced, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is
pre Burt Stardom, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like late 60s.
Burt Reynolds.
Yeah.
I think you said Burt Lancaster.
Burt Reynolds.
Oh, Burt Reynolds. Yes. Okay, yes. Well, that makes perfect sense, because Burt Reynolds was meant to be, in some ways, his relationship with Hal Needham was in some ways the
he said
inspiration.
No. I asked him about that. He said it wasn't.
Okay.
Yeah, that's been reported, but he said not. He said no. It was all the stuntman stuff was all based on this real life stuntman that he heard about.
I'll need him. I really liked this film. And I really liked Rick, and I really liked I can never remember his name. Cliff
Booth.
I'm going senile.
Cliff Booth.
That's my stuntman, Cliff Booth. Oh, DiCaprio's accent in the film, I just love it. Mm. It's such a weird... Where is he meant to be from? He says at one point he's going to go back.
Minnesota?
It's like Minnesota or Missouri or something beginning with that.
What did we think of the scene where Cliff goes to Spahn Ranch, where it kind of turns into like this
so good
70s horror movie for 20-odd minutes, isn't it? How great is that?
Nick has a story about that, don't you, Nick?
The Spahn Ranch?
Mm.
Well, only that I watched it with Quentin Tarantino sitting behind me.
Oh, sorry, you dropped something there, Nick.
And then he stopped it just as it got to the good bit when he was opening the door. And he went, you have to pay to watch the rest.
Just as it got to the good bit.
The really good bit.
That's interesting.
No, it's a great sequence.
How
great
Dakota sequence. Fanning has all the power in that scene, doesn't she? Over Bruce Dern's...
Squeaky.
Squeaky from... So she's the one who tried to assassinate Gerald Ford.
Okay. All right.
Later on.
I didn't know
Years
that.
Later.
You get that. You get that.
Yeah.
She looks like an assassinating type.
Well, what's genuinely, like, you know, I did a bit more reading on the Manson family yesterday, and you know, it was not just those three.
Yeah.
And it was not just this one sort of fairly tight series of murders. Of course, the Tate murders followed by the LaBianca murders a little bit later. So there was quite a lot of general mayhem around them. And also then when their leaders, when Tex and Charles Manson himself and the rest were on trial, they kept trying to disrupt the trials. They kept trying to intimidate witnesses. And certainly the story goes, the supposition is that they killed one of the defense attorneys for not doing a good enough job. He died anyway. He disappeared and then he was found dead during the trial.
Wow. One of the really interesting things about all that is that Bruce Lee was the suspect and he was questioned by the police.
Whoa.
They found a pair of glasses at Sharon Tate's house and they were just like the type Bruce Lee used to wear for reading, and Polanski thought it was him. And so there was a whole thing with Bruce Lee, which is interesting. Jeez.
Steve McQueen, Hollywood was in the grip of a panic of terror after that as well. I read that Steve McQueen and a lot of stars, they obviously increased their security as well, but Steve McQueen walked around with a gun for weeks after that, convinced that he was either going to be next or was going to be targeted as well. It is interesting because at the end of the movie, because Cliff!
He's Eastwood-esque.
I swear,
Cliff Eastwood.
I swear I've seen this movie. I'm telling you. All right, so Rex and Clint, after they dispatch the Manson family members, you do begin to worry about repercussions and the aftermath, and, you know, will they send people to sort Cliff out at the hospital? Good luck to them if they do, clearly. I don't know. Maybe the ending isn't quite as optimistic as we had earlier said, but I think it is.
Mm. Going back to the ranch, I mean, it's great. It's great that it's on a Western set. Mm-hmm. It's where they used to do kind of, and it feels like a kind of, you know, in the main street with people having a, doesn't turn into a shootout, but.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the people, you know, emerging, kind of looking hostile through the door of the saloon and that kind of thing, and they're just standing there staring as dogs bark in the distance.
Yeah, and they send someone away to get the sheriff, as it were. Yeah. Like the guy.
Yeah, it's a really, really tense scene, and it's so well done. And then leavened by that, you know, semi-ridiculous encounter with George Spahn and the old blind man. Oh, is she the redhead? How would I know?
I love that scene. Tarantino said he thinks it's one of the best of his career, and I kind of feel that he's right.
I kind of love how Cliff doesn't tell Rick about it. It's very kind of in character. Maybe he does, but I just like to think that he just goes back and just doesn't even mention it because he's so cool. Mm. It's not even a big deal.
It's not even a big deal.
Like I would probably tell everyone for quite a while.
I mean, he should tell someone because you're not really meant to drive on your spare tire, are you? I mean, that's bad for your car, I think.
Okay.
You need to get that spare tire replaced with a proper tire as soon as possible, guys. So don't make the mistake I might have made last year.
You should have got a hippie to change it.
I should have got a hippie to change it.
Can we talk about how this movie might have changed had Tom Cruise starred in it?
That's news to me. So Tom Cruise is going to star in it?
Yeah, apparently. So whenever Tarantino wrote the script, apparently he sent it out to a few people, and he was at one point talking to Cruise, I presume, about playing
Cliff.
Rick.
No, Cliff.
Or Cliff.
Cliff.
Cliff, definitely Cliff?
Yep, I believe so.
So
I mean, the stuntman thing tracks.
Would that have changed anything? Would, you know, I would love to see, and I love the fact that Cruise is, you know, doing all these Mission Impossible movies and they're incredible, but I would love to see him have a really proper run at an Oscar again. And I don't know whether he's been burned too many times and now he's just happy doing what he does.
There is a theory. There was a very lengthy article a few years ago arguing essentially that since the couch incident, he has shied away from riskier roles. that up until about then, he worked regularly with, you know, indie directors and sort of, you know, took big, big risks in terms of his filmmaking career. And since then, he's been a lot more conservative with a small C in terms of the films that he takes on. So I agree. I would like to see him.
But is working with Quentin Tarantino a risk?
Not a risk in the sense, but
it's a risk for his image,
but,
I guess.
Tom Cruise slamming a woman into a phone.
It's a risk.
I don't mean Tarantino himself as a risk, but the material might be.
I think he would have been great. You start to kind of play scenes out. And I believe Tarantino would have got a different Rick if Cruise had been the Cliff, which I guess kind of makes sense. So you start to wonder who would be the other part of that. But
Harvey Keitel. Tim Roth.
Ben Stiller.
Uncut.
Ben Stiller. Ben Stiller could be Cliff.
Ben Stiller only Cruise as Tom, Rick. But as Tom Cruise.
Cruise, yeah.
Tom Cruise's stunt double.
That's how he's credited. I kind of think it's, you know, you can imagine what could have been, but it's hard to think of a better pair than than these two. I think they'd knock out.
What a lovely pair. But yeah, it would be great to see, because I still get sad about... I love Django Unchained. I think Jamie Foxx is fantastic in that, but I still get a little bit sad thinking, oh, Will Smith could have done that.
Yeah.
It was offered to Will Smith. And he could have actually maybe, you know, been out of his comfort zone a little bit.
Yeah. Could have been Michael Madsen in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah. No, that would have been terrible. Right. So, let's take some questions from listeners. Here is one from Hannah C. Stewart. These are all via DM on Twitter.
Yep.
And Hannah asks, what I'd love you to explore on your podcast is the more subtle treatment of women. QT often comes up against criticism of violence against women, but in this film I felt women were so powerfully portrayed. And we kind of discussed this a little bit, but what I meant to say in relation to that is that I've seen a few articles alleging or saying that Tarantino should be cancelled for his portrayal of women over the years. And I think he's, you know, yes, Reservoir Dogs. No. Obviously not. But I think by and large, he has always tried to write strong, interesting, that may be the key word here, interesting female characters.
I think he's got loads of interesting female characters. I don't think that's actually the point of the argument. And I think there is a very good article, and I have now forgotten where I read it, so that's unhelpful, which basically went film by film and looked at what was very good and what was very bad in some of the films. And
I read a terrible one in The Guardian.
It wasn't The Guardian.
There was one in Time that counted up the minutes of screen time, didn't there?
Oh, there wasn't that one either. Yeah. It wasn't nerdy about it.
I just find that's a bit reductive, isn't it?
No, it wasn't. Yeah. It wasn't nerdy about it that way. It was literally going through and looking at the narrative role of each.
What are the criticisms then?
Well, something like... Death Proof, you have five women just get slaughtered essentially for entertainment before five others then turn the tables. But you're setting up a woman's victory by essentially picking on women to begin with. So it's not unloaded, basically, was the argument. I mean, it's kind of a similar thing in Kill Bill. You know, okay, the bride triumphs, but she has to cut her way through other women to do it. So it's... I don't know. I don't think he's the worst in Hollywood. Like, if we were making a list of, you know, problematic directors, he's nowhere near the top. But at the same time, you know, he's clearly not someone who respects criticism on that basis. And that in itself is a bit worrying to me.
Who's near the top? Go on, tell me. Tell me. You can tell me I'm a doctor.
You're not a doctor, Chris. As your lawyer.
He can't win. I don't know. I read an article yesterday about this film, the new one, saying that all the male characters are being bossed around by the women. You know, all the wives are kind of either nagging or controlling in some way. And even this article said even Brandy the dog was like controlling Cliff. But I mean,
that's nonsense. You can't win then because you
either have weak characters or you have strong characters.
No, but that's absolute nonsense, though, because we see nothing of Francesca bossing Cliff around. And Brandy is absolutely trained to obey to a fault. So that's
the dog.
And is a dog. And so that is clearly nonsense. So look, I'm not gonna defend every single criticism that's ever been made of him, but some of them are legitimate, and you shouldn't throw out the baby with the bathwater, basically.
No, don't do that.
Yeah, it's bad.
If you did that, you would be problematic.
That's correct. Thanks.
Because you shouldn't throw babies anywhere.
So helpful.
You're cancelled.
Wait, what?
Helen is cancelled.
I didn't actually throw any babies.
Hashtag
cancel
baby. Helen.
Hashtag bathwater.
I'm shocked. I didn't think one thing would come out of this podcast would be that Helen would be cancelled for trying to throw babies.
Not. I've already got the Batman fans after me. By the way, the secret number to the bat phone is 530-7972.
Have you called it?
No. It's a Gotham City number. Duh.
Duh. Nick Gerber asks, what scenes, if any, would you cut to shorten the 2-hour, 40-minute runtime?
I'm happy with the runtime. I'd leave it.
I'll be honest, I'll trim down the Lancer stuff a little bit. Certainly the Chili Pepper fiddle one, I would cut that down a little bit myself. Maybe in the 4.5-hour cut, when you put it all back, maybe that becomes more rewarding. But I didn't really kind of follow what was going on there. Anyway,
I would take that out, but I would put the entire Wrecking Crew in. So just you have.
No, I watched the Wrecking Crew. I watched the Wrecking Crew yesterday.
Right,
rotten. It's rotten.
It was interesting.
I can see how she's come across as charming, but the bits are not her, and it's so unfunny.
Is she the best thing in that?
Pretty much, yeah. But it's not even like, it's one of the worst James Bond parodies, it seems to me. In Like Flint is a better James Bond parody than Matt Helm. You know,
it's a Tarantino. We were talking about it, and he went, "Have you seen the movie?" And I was like, and immediately my reaction was just go, "Mm-hmm, yeah." And then he went, "Oh, what do you think of it?" And I was like, "Oh God, do not be trapped in this cul-de-sac." And I just fessed up. No, I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it because I didn't want something to go, "What was your best bit?"
Well, about the Wrecking Crew,
about his Wrecking Crew,
the Wrecking Crew, the characters.
No, I have seen Once Upon a Time. Question from JG Murray. I'm getting names all wrong today. At Gillian Gill Murray, what does a pod think of the reading of the film as a celebration of traditional macho values? Despite Brad Pitt's character's depiction as a possible wife murderer, are we not supposed to cheer as he dismisses and destroys the counterculture?
Yeah, it certainly seems to hate hippies. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it says over and over again, like, it fucking hippies.
Rick hates hippies. Yeah, Cliff is waving at them, and he's a little bit more. And he buys some drugs from them. You know, he's more on board. It's Rick who hates them.
Okay,
and probably
fair.
Hates them because of professional reasons, and he sees them as being young people. He probably hates all young people, right?
He's
an old man yelling at people to get off his lawn in a weird way, isn't he?
Old man yells at clouds.
He's a bit like that.
But it is a celebration of those values, isn't it? It's not a satirical take on those values, is it? It's not like a pointed critique of them.
Well, like, is Paul Revere seen to be like a hippie band? The band that Sharon Tate listens to? Because that seems to be more like mainstream young people thing of the time. And I feel like he's okay with that. But there is no evidence in this film that he's in any way cool with hippies, I feel like.
I'm not sure he's endorsing Rick and Cliff entirely. I mean, they're racist thing. Yeah. And also, I'd noticed when I saw it the second time, they litter a lot. Like, there's a great scene where DiCaprio, where Rick gets on the lot, he's having a coffee, and then he just stops.
He throws it,
but doesn't drop it. He throws it on the floor. It really made me laugh. But yeah, they're not, I mean, they're not model citizens, are they?
No.
I think hippies, for the most part in this movie, are represented by the Manson family.
Yeah, who are perhaps not. And actually also were, like, let's be clear, they were not true hippies. They were not about peace and love, most obviously. But they also were massively racist. Their whole thing was igniting a race war. Yep. So, you know, again, not hippie values as far as I'm aware.
Terrible shits.
There's a great Quentin Tarantino likes to dress up when he's shooting. So for the Lancer stuff, he would sometimes wear a cowboy outfit. And there's a great behind the scenes photo online of him shooting a scene with the Manson family where he's wearing like full hippie gear with like a kind of bandana, and it's amazing. Look it up. So I think I get the sense that he loves all those counterculture movies.
Yeah,
as much as he likes the old fashioned stuff. I think he loves both.
Yeah. Mm. I think this is the stuff he grew up with. I don't think he's condemning it in any way, shape, or form. And I think that Rick Dalton's a deeply, deeply flawed character, and he's the one who's has that margarita fueled rant at the Manson family. So I don't know that Tarantino's endorsing that. As for Cliff, always coming full circle to where we started, I think you're meant to be unsettled. I think you're meant to laugh cathartically at the violence that's happening and then catch yourself and go, oh, hang on. What's happening here? And even at the end, when Chekhov's flamethrower is unfailed, I think you're meant to question yourself a little bit as
What's Chekhov doing this year? We've had Chekhov's corridor full of knives, Chekhov's flamethrower.
Well, in fairness, Chekhov's corridor of knives in John Wick Chapter 3, this is a spoiler special for that as well, by the way, is introduced in the first act and deployed instantly.
That's true. Chekhov's gauntlet?
That's not Chekhov.
Here we have Chekhov's acid-tipped cigarette. We have Chekhov's flamethrower and Chekhov's killer dog, all in the same film, all coming to a nice boil.
Chekhov had a heck of a arsenal, didn't he?
He really did.
Yeah.
How great is the flamethrower? I'm trying to remember the line early on in the movie where it flashes back to him learning how to use the flamethrower.
Isn't it? Oh yeah, it's a bit hot. Yeah, Can we cut that down?
That's a flamethrower. Oh, it's just scary.
What's the kiss-off line in the 14 Fists itself? Of McCluskey. It's something like, anyone order
sauerkraut. Fried sauerkraut.
Fried, not grilled. Okay.
It's very important. Yeah, important.
I mean, it's sautéed. I mean, I must know what cooking method he uses.
I know a really boring bit of trivia about that.
Bring it.
That
Go
scene.
For it, Nick.
Are you
Love
ready?
It. Go
yeah.
for it.
All right. So during the 14 Fists and McCluskey scene, the music is unused Bernard Herrmann music for Torn Curtain.
Wow.
Ooh.
Very good knowledge.
That was pretty boring, right?
That's nice. Great.
Really?
I love
that's
that.
That's great. That's fantastic.
What was the music at the Spawn Ranch when he's in the going down the corridor? So it's what she's listening to on TV.
Yes. I think it's from Torn Curtain as well.
Okay, cool. Good work.
I'm trying to remember what the bit of music at the end, when the final shot where it sort of cranes over the fence and Rick is meeting Sharon. It's music from an old movie. I'm going to look it up.
Do it. There's a reference to Audie Murray early on. Did people hear that?
Audie Murphy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, someone calls Cliff.
Clint. You got it right.
Cliff.
Clint.
It's Cliff.
Yes.
Cliff Booth.
I said Cliff. You said Clint.
No, you said Clint.
Cliff.
Cliff.
Someone calls Cliff Audie Murphy, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Okay.
So do people know who that is, do we think?
Let's tell him anyway.
He was a real-life World War II hero.
Yes, he was.
He was a tiny, scrawny man. Tiny little fella.
Bite your legs.
Who basically... Yeah, but he basically bit the Nazis' legs. Like, he basically one-man armied the shit out of World War II to the point when they decided to make a film about him, they couldn't find anyone to play him except him. So he played himself in the sort of propaganda biopic of his own life.
That kind of echoes Inglourious Basterds, isn't it?
Yeah, very much.
Daniel Brühl plays himself.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was just a nice little reference.
It's lovely. Also, what do we think of the extended Red Apples commercial at the end? Tarantino's first kind of post-credits bit of flippery.
I thought it was fun. You kind of imagine that... The Vega brothers watched that as a kid and decided to smoke that.
That's exactly what I was saying. Or Butch, who literally does smoke red apples in Pulp Fiction, and he talks about smoking cigarettes and watching Captain Kangaroo, which obviously is a quote from a song. But at the same time, you think, did he watch Rick Dalton?
Yeah.
And it just gives this lovely idea of this movie taking place in that alternate extended Quentin Tarantino verse.
Yeah.
This idea of a shared cinematic universe is really interesting.
It'll never
and I think
catch
it's
up.
Something that people should explore, perhaps vis-a-vis superheroes.
Superhero. Yeah, good shout, man.
I don't see it working.
Yeah.
So does that mean Stuntman Randy is related to Stuntman Mike?
You never know.
Brothers. I saw a slight resemblance.
Yeah. It did look like almost the same person.
It could be a father and son, couldn't it?
Could be a father and son. You don't know. You just don't know.
I want to know what rat-flavoured dog food tastes like, or raccoon.
That's a very interesting way he has of that dog food delivery system.
I just thought that took forever on film. I thought, is this ever going to end?
Most stomach-churning thing in the entire movie was Cliff throwing his cigarette into that pan.
Yeah, no.
Yeah. Don't do that. Yeah. No, it's not good. It's
also, no, licking the dog food was also pretty gnarly.
No, totally on board with that.
Really?
But yeah.
It's rat-flavoured dog food. It's rat-flavoured dog
food.
Sure,
it's essence of rat. Mm.
It literally says rat-flavoured dog food.
Oh, well.
I just want to say, there's another Inglourious Basterds reference. One of the films that Rick makes in Italy is directed by Antonio Margheriti, who is obviously the pseudonym of Donny Donovitz in Inglourious Basterds.
Good knowledge.
Whoa.
Very good.
I did not read that off the internet.
I have one last question. Can I have one last question?
Of course.
If this is Quentin Tarantino's penultimate film, what would we like to see him do for his last film?
Oh, let's get into this.
I think he's talking about doing a horror film, hasn't he? Which, looking at Spawn Ranch, you think was great.
Yeah.
There's talk of a London gangster film about 5 years ago. There was talk that he was thinking of making a gangster film over here.
Okay. I like this idea of a Quentin Tarantino rom-com. He made that thing when he was a kid, didn't he? My best friend's birthday or something like that. And that has elements of that, I think. So I'd like to see him deconstruct and reconstruct rom-coms. That'd be great.
He's very good at meet-cutes, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's very, you know, Reservoir Dogs hinges on a meet-cute. So an undercover cop meets a diamond thief and, you know, they get up to all sorts of shenanigans.
And when you go on Pulp Fiction, you go on the date with Mia and...
You do, yeah.
You go on, you get the whole date. You're not cutting around from the date. Oh, it's a date, the date is the thing, isn't it?
Okay,
it's great.
It's going to be a rom-com with a body count, but
yeah.
I would. Well, didn't he kind of do that already though with True Romance?
I'll get my coat then. Thank you.
I don't want his last film to be a Star Trek film, but apart from that, I'm pretty flexible.
Here's my thing. I think this 10, I think he's probably stubborn enough to stick to this 10 films an hour thing.
Yes.
But I really don't think he should. Say he makes his 10th film, and say, for example, just setting aside the argument that this is his 10th film, let's say this is his 9th film, 9th and a bit, counting 4 rooms, and say he makes the 10th film, say 4 or 5 years down the line, and it's great, and then he goes, right, that's it, I'm done, I'm retired. But one day he's walking down the street and this idea pops into his head for the perfect Quentin Tarantino film, but he goes, nah, I'm not going to make it because I've done my 10, I'm out. Mm. Who's that benefit?
You've
Who does that
six.
Benefit?
Yeah, I just think he's going to go into streaming and television. I just think long-form stories is where he's at.
Netflix.
And that'll get him out of his 10-film filmography thing, wouldn't it?
I think another way of getting around it is to call a Quentin Tarantino film a film that he writes and directs, whereas if he did Star Trek, he's not writing that. Therefore, he could say it's just a kind of a gun for hire. I'm a Sam Wanamaker. It's not necessarily a Quentin Tarantino film.
Maybe like Sam Wanamaker, he'll rebuild the globe somewhere.
Nick, what would you like to
How
see?
How good was Nicholas Hammond as Sam Wanamaker,
Spider-Man, man.
I've got to
Spider-Man
say, MVP of that movie. I loved this scene. That's so good.
What would you like? What film would you like to see Tarantino make last?
You know what? I'd kind of like to see another Kill Bill. Of all his films, that one I'd quite like to see him go back to. Because they kind of set it up. Mm-hmm. It's the young girl. He's going to go up against the bride.
Yep.
And I kind of think he's got a hook there. And I just, they're just fun. It would be fun. It would be good to see him go out on a really fun note, high energy note. But yeah, I don't know. It'd be cool to see him do sci-fi. So I guess the Star Trek thing. That doesn't feel like a good fit though, does it?
Let me be clear. Yeah, I am 100% on board with Quentin Tarantino doing sci-fi. I remain very much to be convinced about Quentin Tarantino doing Star Trek.
I think I know the film that you would be totally on board for him doing.
Oh no.
Ant-Man and the Wasps. Maybe this is why they didn't announce an Ant-Man 3 for Marvel's Phase 4, because they're holding on. We'll find out one day, and hopefully he'll come back on the podcast and talk about it. But until then, that is it for our Once Upon a Time in Hollywood spoiler special. Hope you enjoyed it. Our next spoiler special, all things being equal, will be for a little film I like to call It Chapter 2.
Ooh.
With the director and producer sibling partnership, Andy and Barbara Muschietti. So that will be, hopefully, a lot of fun. Fingers crossed that actually happens.
It'll be
obviously, hugely terrifying, and people dressed up in clown suits. But enough about me.
It's a long one as well, isn't it? It's almost 3 hours, like this one. So I wonder if there'll be 2 hours of just Pennywise driving around, just like really intense horror at the end
with his manky feet up on the dashboard.
There'll be people driving around, but just past his gutter, and it'll be just a one shot on the gutter as cars pass.
I'd watch it.
Would totally be there. Anyway, until then, until an auspicious occasion, until we meet again, the regular Empire podcast is, of course, out every single Friday, so do listen for that as well. And we're going on tour. The regular podcast is going on tour. Very, very exciting. We've been hoping to do this for a while, and we're doing a little toe-in-the-water mini tour of the UK through September and October, starting September 14th at the London Podcast Festival at King's Place in London, then September 19th, the Cameo in Edinburgh, September 26th, City Screen in York, October 3rd, Fact in Liverpool, October 10th, The Duke at Comedia in Brighton, and then October 17th, A Sort of Homecoming, Helen.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. We're going to Belfast, so we are, as part of the Cinemagic Festival, 30th anniversary.
Chris isn't reading that. He's got that off the top of his head. That's amazing.
He actually
been working on this for a long time. I know these dates off by heart, and trust me. So go to the Empire website or check our respective Twitter feeds for more details on how to get tickets for those if you are so inclined. We would love to see you there. And do like and subscribe to the podcast if you can. Right, that's it. It is goodbye from Ian Freer.
I'm Ian Freer, and don't you fucking forget it.
It's goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
I'm as real as donut, motherfuckers.
Are these quotes in the film?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Why else would anyone say that?
That's a lovely non sequitur. I like it. When does he say that?
I think Tex says it when Brad Pitt asks, "Are you real?"
Ah, yes, yes, yes. That's a funny bit. It's a goodbye from Nick Dissembly.
And away we go.
That's from the Dark
Knight. That's exactly how Brad Pitt says it. That's why I didn't play Cliff. I got through to the final round.
Yeah.
Damn it.
So close.
And it's a goodbye from me. As you can probably tell, I don't remember any lines from this movie, so I'm not going to...
Clint, something about Clint.
Yeah, I'm just going off to study a chart for 4 hours. It simply says, Cliff Booth. Cliff Booth. Cliff. Anyway, thanks so much for listening. I've been Clint Booth. See you next time. Bye.